Thank you, thank you, thank you, Judy, and your ministry to us and the choir. Thank you for every week being so diligent and getting out early this morning in the frozen tundra. You know, you guys always outdo the second service in the frozen tundra times. You guys, percentage-wise, y'all show up so good. You're not afraid of the snow. I guess you've braved it a few times, so thank you for coming out. And hopefully this will, yes. Oh, great picture. See how good-looking our pastor is? Good-looking dude, isn't he? Right? Oh, no, I heard a no. Yeah. That's a great. And Josh, without the hair, he's still a good-looking chap, isn't he? Yeah, great pictures. Is there the one with the flag? Do you have that one and the flag in the back? Oh, wow. How about that, huh? You don't think Dad and Mom are proud of that day, huh? Isn't that something? Wow. Thank God for his service. Yeah, thank you for that, guys. Thanks for having that. That'll help you to remind you to pray for them, and especially Josh now. I think they'll get where will they go, Ron? Do you know where he and Allison?
Okay. Right there.
Down in Texas. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for sharing. Well, we're going to drink out of a fire hydrant today. We're in Luke 15, and so there is no way that we could cover Luke 15, 11 through 32 together today. There wouldn't be any chance of that happening. There's just too much. So we're going to bite off a small piece, spend a little time in Luke 15, start with verse 11, most definitely. It's going to be a lot. You've heard of the prodigal son, right? Everybody's heard of that story. I'm sure that you have. I think it was Charles Dickens and Ralph Waldo Emerson. They both said, this is the greatest story ever told. Now, those two guys have definitely written a few great stories themselves, and they said it's the greatest story. Rembrandt painted a picture we're going to look at in just a moment. I put it on the front of the bulletin today. Do y'all know the name of that painting? That's The Return of the Prodigal Son. And it is argued right up there with the Mona Lisa and others to be the greatest painting, definitely the greatest oil painting ever painted in a lot of artists' opinion. Why? Why is it getting so much attention? Well, if that weren't enough, Hank Williams, good old boy from Kentucky, actually wrote a gospel song called The Prodigal Son. Now, that's really something. And so this story is the most known and most well worldwide told story in all the Bible. And so we want to get at it a little bit. We're teaching in detail on Sunday night, and it's on YouTube if you ever want to go to Bible Hour with Stoney and check out. We started last week, and we're going to walk through this story on our Sunday nights in detail. But this morning, we're going to, like I said, drink out of a fire hydrant. There's so much here that we can only get a few minutes worth, but I hope that it's helpful. Verse 11. Luke 15, verse 11. And he said, a man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. So he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and he went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Verse 14. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country and he began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country. And he sent him into the fields to feed swine. Uh-oh. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. Verse 17. But when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. So he got up and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and had compassion. He felt compassion for him. And he ran and he embraced him and he kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven, and in your sight I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to the slaves, Quickly, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put the ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to celebrate. Now, we're going to have to stop right there. We can't get any further in this story today because we won't have time. But let's think, first of all, about where this story sits in the book of Luke. It's very important to know our context. Unfortunately, today, when people deal with this story, they try to apply it too quickly without interpreting it. And that's the problem anyway in the church today. So many are trying to apply Bible stories without really doing a thorough, diligent interpretation of the story. It is a tragic mistake, to try to take the Bible and put it into today's context. We're to take our context and put it into the Bible days. Very different interpretation when you do that. When you apply it, it applies very differently. Why would Shakespeare say this is the best story ever written, and he used many times the same motif, the same plot sequence as was used in this story Jesus told? Why would Shakespeare do that? This story is the greatest story ever told. It certainly is. Now, you say, well, wait a minute, I thought the gospel was. Well, the gospel is in here. No doubt about it, the gospel is here. But you have to go back to the context of that day to see it. You can't bring it to today or you miss it. All right? Understand something about a parable. A parable is not a story told to illustrate a point. That's not why a parable is written. Jesus didn't give parables so that he could prove a point to somebody. It's not what a parable is. A parable is an introduction to an alternative reality. And then you are asked to join that reality. Let me put it to you in another way. It is a story asking us, where do you fit in the story? Far more than just a point to illustrate something. That's not what Jesus is doing. Now, in the book of Luke, you have, by the way, Luke is the longest gospel. It's not the longest gospel by chapter and verse, but by words. It is the longest gospel. Good quiz question for your friends. Which one's the longest gospel? They're going to go Matthew. And you'll say Luke, and they'll say, no, Luke's four chapters shorter. You'll say, no, actually it's not. Actually, it's much longer as far as words go than any of the gospels. And so let's think about where this parable sits. Because in our thinking, we normally think, okay, you write a book from the beginning to the end, and by the end, you get to the most important part, right? That's not how the book of Luke is written. The book of Luke is written with the first nine chapters up to, oh, say, verse 50 in chapter 9. It's written with the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and then we get to the point where Jesus has his Galilean ministry. So chapter 9, verse 51, all the way through about chapter 19, verse 24, we get to another section, and there's 20 parables in this section. Then at the end, of course, is when he turns toward Jerusalem to the crucifixion. Now, within those 20 parables of the book of Luke, there is a precipice. And right in the middle, or the peak of all those parables, sets this story. So Luke doesn't write it from, okay, let's start with the beginning and then the end, and then the most profound story will come right there at the very end. The most profound story, the most impactful story, which has impacted the world more than any other story, is the one in the middle, right at the peak. the prodigal son. That's the way the book is written. And so we are to pay close attention to this story. And so if you look at this picture, look at it very closely. I've titled the sermon Three Extremes. We will not be able to cover one of the extremes, but two of the extremes, if you'll look to the left, you see the boy, right? And that's the younger brother. And if you look closely, you'll be able to see that he has one shoe on and one shoe off. Now, why? Well, in that day, they have a belief that if you didn't have shoes, you were a what? A slave. So, on the one hand, he has an inheritance that the father wants to give him. On the other hand, he's a slave and he has nothing. Right? So Rembrandt is capturing within this one guy, this younger brother has the inheritance or he has it not. It's his choice today. And the father is embracing him. Look at the father's hands. Do you notice anything unique about the father's hand? Excuse me for my coughing. I'm getting those sinus thing. But do you notice anything different about his hands? Yeah, they're different. One's bigger. Where's the hand that's bigger? In that day, a father, when he was really instructing and embracing his son, a father, if he wanted to be endearing to his son, would do what? Grab him by the shoulder. Now, we do a little bit of that. Now, listen. Right? You ever had one of those talks? The two-inch talk, nose to nose. Now, listen. That's a father's embrace. That's how a father embraced his son. I love you, son. Now, let's talk. But where's the other hand? It's a thinner hand, more feminine, isn't it? It's a thinner one, right in the middle of his back. What's that touch from? Mother. Rembrandt's picture, are you getting how special this picture really is? There's so much here. And the father and the son, now watch the older son. What's he wearing? Right. What's the father wearing? What's the older son saying? I'm of the same importance that you are. And that's what that would say. Remember the idea here where he said, bring out the robe? That's that robe. Look what the older son has on. He's got a robe same color as daddy. What's he saying? I'm just as special as you. There's so much in this painting. Now, the three extremes. You've got the boy who, if you look closely, what kind of hairdo does he have? like mine, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks shaved, doesn't it? Why do you suppose that it's shaved, but then he's got a little bit left over here? It's a real crude, if you can see it. Maybe you want to Google it sometimes. It's a real crude hair shaving because there's some left on the side. The way he leaves it leaves it really, you know what it looks like? And most people in that culture, this was an issue. What would they have to do sometimes to your hair? Shave it because why? What would you get? Lice. Right. Vermin. Right. You would have all kinds of intruders taking up residence in your hair. This shows what about the younger brother? He has been to the bottom, hasn't he? Down and out. There's so much captured in a hairdo. And he leaves just enough hair to see he's had it crudely shaven off. Not a good barber, but he may have just hacked it off himself because of the itching. Now, you see, you catch all of this when you think of the extremes. This story has the extreme on both sides. But here's what I don't want us to miss. Both of the brothers are equally lost. Both of the brothers have the same extreme problem with pride. Although one is as far away from the father as he can be, where did he go, the story says? To a where? A far country. The older brother is as close to the father as he can be, but both are what? Both are lost. Both are sinful. Both are full of pride. One as far away from the Father as he can be. The other as close to the Father as he can be. This story that Jesus tells captures the two extremes and everything in between. Now, what would the third extreme be in this picture? The Father. Now, how in the world could we expect the Father to love this fella? Now, let's look at this real quick. How could we expect it? Who was the audience, by the way? Who's listening? Why is Jesus telling the story? Well, verse 1 and 2 gives you the answer. Who's listening in? Why is Jesus telling this story? The Pharisees. Yeah, that's right. So far, the Pharisees and Jesus have gotten along nicely. They've been really good buddies, right? Oh, wait, am I wrong? They haven't gone along at all. In fact, they've both called each other the same thing. You're of Satan. They have not gotten along very well. You know, I've had those experiences in 30 years of ministry. You guys have probably too. Where you get sideways with somebody and they don't like you and you don't like them and you're in ministry and they're just like, well, you're a this and you're a that, and you go back and forth and it's just horrible, horrible. And it's not God honoring, is it? But there comes a certain point where you have to say, look, you and I can't serve the same Jesus. If I don't, I'm in trouble. If you don't, you're in trouble. But we certainly don't serve the same Jesus. That's what happened with Jesus and the Pharisees. They said, well, you're of Satan, Jesus. Why? Why did they say that? Because you hang out with who? Sinners. And then Jesus says, no, you're of Satan because why? Because you don't hang out with sinners and tax collectors. Now, are they at an impasse? I believe we've got ourselves a difficult situation, don't we? What's going to give? This story is the only parable that directly inserts the Pharisee. It directly puts him in there. So which one is the Pharisee? The older son. Jesus, to this point, has not just absolutely put it a zinger to them. Now, what's a parable? A parable is a story that everybody can relate to, which has an ethical question that you have to answer, and it has a Christ-centered zinger at the end. That's what a parable is. One more time. It's a story, first of all, that everybody can relate to. They knew all about what it meant for a wayward son and an older son. They knew this story. They could relate, just like they could with the coin and with the shepherd and the sheep. They can relate to these stories. That's what a parable is. But it always has an ethical question. Why an ethical question? What does the ethical question do to the listener? What does it do? Makes you think. Draws you in. Come to a conclusion. You begin to say, yeah, I can not only relate to that story, but yeah, I'm a pretty good dude. I'm in that story, and I'm a pretty good dude. And then comes the zinger. Jesus always puts the zinger in there. And so the zinger we'll get to in just a minute, but what is this extreme younger brother, what's he been into? First of all, he asked for his father's estate. You see that? He asked that he would get his share of the estate. Now, again, I told you context, context, context. We don't catch this if we're not paying attention to the original language, because he doesn't say, give me clarion, this Greek word for give me my estate, because clarion would mean give me the part of the business so that I can get busy making it a better business for the family. He doesn't say that. He says, Tes Jesus, give me my stuff, like a little crybaby. I want my stuff. Y'all ever see Andy Griffith, I Want My Bike? You ever see that episode? Some of y'all are laughing. There's a little spoiled boy in there, and I want my bike, right? And he cries and pitches a fake fit, and then his dad sells his bike, right? Great, great Andy Griffith episode. But that's what this boy's saying. Give me my stuff. So if you're a Pharisee and you're listening to this, it might be somewhat natural for a boy to say, give me the estate so that I can get busy. I can turn it into a better business to make more money for the family. Y'all know what a family business is. You know, it used to be you had family farms and the kids would grow up and help the business keep growing stronger. And you had families that had businesses together. And we don't see that much anymore. But in that day, that's mostly all they saw. And so it would be natural for him to say, you know, I can do better with my share of the estate. I can make more money for us, Dad. You think I could have a shot at it now? He'd have been in his teenage years, and he would have been able to say, you know, I think I can really do better, Dad. Can I have a shot at it? That would have been natural. But when Jesus says, Tes Jesus, he says, you know what those Pharisees would have said? They'd have said, what? That's what they would have responded, what? What in the world did that boy just say to his daddy? You've got to be kidding me. He basically said, I don't want to have anything to do with the family. Give me my stuff that I have coming to me. I'm out of here. Do you know what the word, when he talks about the estate, there's a word in here, bios. The word bios comes from we get that word life, like biology and life. What do we say when we make money? We say, I'm going to go make a living. There it is. That's where that word comes from, make a living. What he is saying is, I want my stuff, but I don't want to have it so that I can help make a living for you, Dad. I don't care if you what? I don't care if you die. In fact, here's the reason why Jesus tells the story to get the reaction out of the Pharisees. Dad, I wish you were dead. That's what he's saying. I wish you were dead. Now, that is shameful, isn't it? Dad, I wish you were dead. Give me my stuff. You see, because in that day, if someone gave you their inheritance, they gave you your estate, you would still, if you were the father, you would still have control over it. You would still call the shots because they were in their teenage years. They shouldn't have control over it, but then you would work them into it and they would begin to run the business. And yes, it would be their share, but they wouldn't take control of it. But that's not what happens here. The father says, okay. And the Pharisees say, no, he didn't. That's what kids say today. No, you didn't, right? That's what the Pharisees would have said. No, he didn't. He did not just say that to his daddy. Because that would mean he breaks up the whole business. This son is willing to break up the business so his dad will have no way to make a living. He would kill his dad. He would literally kill his dad to go enjoy some money. Yeah, that's what he's saying. That's why, to get back in the context, we finally get into the rage the Pharisees must have been saying. He would have killed his daddy. Now, what happens next? His daddy gives him the stuff, and the Pharisees are saying, no way a dad does that. That's crazy. What kind of dad would do such a thing to give the boy what he wanted so that he could experience the hurt and the devastation so that he could one day come back home? What kind of dad would do such a thing? What kind of story is this? You've lost your mind, Jesus. This is preposterous. No one would do that. No dad in his right mind would be that willing to give to the boy what he wants so he could learn his lesson and that he could come into a right relationship with his daddy. You see, because he doesn't have a right relationship with his daddy. So his dad says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to let you have what you want because I love you. That's Romans chapter 1. God gives us over to our reprobate minds. He gives us over. You know, the church is supposed to do that for people who want to live in sin. Give their flesh over to sin so that what can be saved? Their souls can be saved. That's the job of the church. Sometimes we do too much pandering. Oh, no, let him go. The Father let him go so that he could learn quickly what it would be like to be outside of the Father's presence. Right? Now, I want to show you something. And before we run out of time here, I've got an illustration for you. We're not going to go over this, so don't let it, don't, oh my goodness. Yeah. So anyway, I hope y'all brought a lunch because we're going to go over every one of these points. We're not, actually. In interpreting Bible stories, you could, if you have the time and the inclination, I know Jay does this kind of thing, and when you, if you would like, you can diagram a story. You ever diagram a sentence? You can diagram a story. And so this story is broken up into two sections. And each point that Jesus makes has a counterpoint. In other words, the son that I had is dead. When it says that he's dead, what does it mean when it says he's dead? Did you know in that culture that when a son did something like that to his daddy, they had a funeral? Did you know that? They literally had a funeral in a casket. And they buried him. Because the son I once had is now dead. And so the community would say, yeah, sure, that's absolutely right. He's dead to the Father. They'd do a funeral. They'd say, he's so shameful. He said it when he got his estate. He didn't want to belong to this family, so we'll have a funeral and he's out. That's what they would do. Well, Jesus then gives that point that he's dead to the family now, but what does the Father say when the son comes home? My son that was dead is now what? Alive. So if you look at the top one, A, you go down to the bottom, A, and you'll see the word resurrection, because in the perfect story that Jesus tells, he has a counterpart to every point. So if he says, my son is dead because of what he's done, then he has a counterpoint. My son has come home. He's resurrected from the dead. So there's a point in everything Jesus makes. There's a counterpoint. All right? Now, we won't go all over all of those, okay? We won't have time. But in this story, the Father, you get the idea, the Father is standing up in the house, and he is looking for the younger son to come home, right? Because he says he saw him, where did he see the son? At the front door? He saw him far away, so number one, he's watching for him, and number two, he must be a really rich guy, and he had one of the houses that was high in the village, so he could see afar off. The son is outside the town. I'm going to be the son, and I'm walking toward the town, and the village is way on the other side of the stage, and I'm walking toward, and I'm rehearsing my speech, and I look up, and there's this man running at me. Understand one thing. Noble men in the first century do not run. The word in the Greek here is for a Greek Olympic sprinter. That's the word. Dad is sprinting. Now, how ridiculous do you think he looks? How would he be able to run? You got to gird up your loins. So he would pull his robe. Pull it up and tie, that's called gird up your loins, and tie it off. And he'd have his robe bagged up here, look like a big diaper, and then he would be sprinting right through the town. What do you never show, ever show the community when you're a nobleman? Never show even a part of your leg. There's an old rabbi that said, well, if you're sitting somewhere and a bird crawls under your robe, you have to wait till dark to move. So good luck to you. You couldn't move. You had to wait till dark to get the bird out. Because if you didn't, you'd raise the robe to grab the bird and you'd show your legs, right? You couldn't show your legs. Noble people did not show their legs. The son is on his way in after having a funeral already for him. He's walking toward the town. What's going to happen to that boy when he gets to town? When he gets in town, what's going to happen to him? After what he's done to his family and his daddy, what's going to happen? Oh, shame. They will shun him. They will spit on him. He will be accosted in some way, maybe beaten. Who knows what may happen to him, because the town will consider him dead. All right. Who comes running? The dad. Picture this. Dad's in his house watching for the boy to come. And of course, this is a picture of God, isn't it? He's waiting for us to come home. He goes running. The boy's he's rehearsing, saying, if I could just be one of my dad's hired men. What was a hired man? So there were slaves. The slaves actually got to live in the house. A hired man's below the slave. A hired man stands out on the corner and says, could I have a job today? And you would go hire him. So he says, I could at least be a hired man for my daddy. So he's thinking, I'll go get hired and get a little bread for my dad and I won't starve to death. He had previously said I could at least be like a pig and eat some of the pig food, which would have made the Pharisees lose it, right? And so here comes the dad sprinting. And so the son, who should have experienced all the shame, doesn't. Guess who gets the shame? Guess who has the whole town saying, oh, look at that. That's horrible. Shame, shame, shame. Nobody should do such a thing. I guess you're not what I thought you were. What a disappointment you are. You can hear some lot worse things in your mind now, what people would be saying, but they're not saying it about the boy. Who are they saying it about? The dad. What's the picture? Jesus Christ came running to us to take our shame. Jesus says, when they hate you, it's because they hate me. He took our blame, our shame, our shamefulness, our sinfulness. He took it upon himself. He raised the robe and he sprinted to us to keep us from what? An eternity of shame. Now, something interesting, and this is where I want to close, and then our children are going to sing for us. Can you put the next one up there for us, guys? Watch when you diagram the older son. There's a point and there's a counterpoint to everything Jesus has said in this entire story, but watch this. There's no counterpoint at the end of the older son's story. The missing ending. It's not there. This is why Shakespeare said, oh, I've got to use this. There's motif, there's plot. I've got to use, and that's why in so many of Shakespeare's, you are the ones that finish the story. That's how Jesus told it. He left it open-ended. Now, wouldn't it be great if the end of the story was the older son, he comes in and loves the father and accepts the love of the father, and he embraces his brother and he sits down and he celebrates with the father. And wouldn't that be a wonderful ending? How does it actually end if the older brother is the Pharisee? Tell me how it ends. Because he's about to turn toward Jerusalem. What happens in Jerusalem? The older son picks up a stick and beats the daddy to death. That's how it ends. That's what makes the prodigal son story so powerful, is that they had the choice to end the story how they chose. And they chose to kill the father. Now, we've been given a choice by our pastor, haven't we? You gonna get on the bus or not? You going to get on the bus and celebrate? Isn't that what they did? Celebrate? Where'd that older boy stay? Outside from the celebration. But you know what? I say get on the bus and let's celebrate. Let's do it. Now our children are going to come down and sing a song for us. I think it's very fitting, and then we'll close out. Come on down, guys.